He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakaronga mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Thanks for joining us on Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today we're at one of the oldest sale yards in the country, watching sheep and cattle go under the hammer at Colgate.
A Lincoln University graduate puts all the eggs in one basket, rebranding her family's poultry farm.
And later, we're digging in the snow on Mount Ruapehu with a dog called Echo. He's using his highly tuned sense of smell to save lives in the mountains.
But first, to our look at conditions on the land this week.
In Northland, a couple of bull sales have been held in the Kaipara region near Dargaville, and good sums are achieved off the back of decent prices for beef. About double the usual rainfall over the last month, followed by sunny days later in the week, means the grass is starting to grow, and acres of land is being used to harvest the sun, with a solar farm to generate power for the national grid getting underway. And growers have at last been able to get their tractors onto fields around Pukekohe in dry and sunny weather.
Farmers are smiling in Waikato with warm weather following weeks of heavy rain. Most are near the end of calving. The cost of palm kernel means more dairy farmers are investigating other feed options and some are turning to molasses. There's an excess of silage and some farmers are stocking up in case of drought later on. Despite plenty of recent rain, the water table's still quite low after about 4 years of pretty dry weather. It's been blue skies in the latter half of the week for the Bay of Plenty, much to the relief of orchardists and farmers. However, lovely weather doesn't change the labour shortage for kiwi fruit pruning. Some orchardists are about 2 weeks behind schedule and hope RSE workers can keep up with the demand. With higher wage rates this season, some orchardists are noticing their workers not showing up on a Friday, as they've earned enough for the week by then and take an extra day off. Gold kiwi fruit will be budding next month, so the pressure's on to get the vines pruned and tied in time. Dairy farmers near Tauranga say their hills are drying off nicely and they're able to get around without getting stuck in mud.
On the east coast near Gisborne, ewe scanning has shown up a decent percentage of twins and lambing is underway in some parts of the region. It's been fairly mild this week, but there's still plenty of mud underfoot. Some isolated rural roads are inaccessible and can take up to 2 years to be repaired, so farmers are mustering stock down to lower pastures. In Hawke's Bay, vineyards are being pruned and maintenance continues. There have been a few frosts and bud bursts expected to start in several weeks' time. The recent rain has clogged turf, but it's drying out and tractors are back on the vineyards. Some Chardonnay blocks are being replaced and more of the Albarino grape variety is also going in.
King Country farmers are in awe of the high soil temperatures compared to usual. Jeff Burton farms in Tomaranui and has kept about 35 years of soil temperature records. He says the maximum temperature expected at this time of the year is about 8 degrees and pasture doesn't grow. But things have changed.
Just this morning I measured my soil temperatures at the recommended 9 a.m. time and they were 12 degrees. So that is 3 to 4 degrees above normal. And the effect of that is, and I've just shifted my cattle and my hoggets, which are on a winter rotation, and the growth behind them is more than I've ever seen, which is what you would expect at 12 degrees and moisture.
Jeff Burton says lambing is starting and ewes are in good condition thanks to the ideal growing conditions, but he warns it's important not to overfeed ewes coming into lambing. There are also concerns spring could be drier than usual and lead into an exceptionally hot summer. Mount Taranaki has a bright cap of snow, but the levels aren't as low as is often the case for this time of the year thanks to recent heavy rain washing it away. Paddocks are pretty wet underfoot, but a few days of fine weather this week is easing that problem. Grass has died in flooded pasture, so contractors will be drilling new seed to sprout in the spring. A local vet says calving's going well. They haven't had as many call-outs this year. And as with other regions, the lack of labour is quite stressful, with everyone working longer hours.
In Wairarapa, it's clean-up time in the hills, as slips have taken out farming tracks, fences, and forced farmers to walk around paddocks that can't be reached by bike or tractor. Beef and sheep farmers are waiting for the land to dry out a bit more before bringing diggers in to help. It's been sunny this week, but more rain and a southerly is expected to strike in a few days. Hill farmers haven't started lambing and are anticipating lots of lambs on the ground. Scanning results, particularly with Coopworth crosses, have been over 170% for some farmers. Dairy farmers in southern Wairarapa are still dealing with boggy pastures. It's soggy underfoot too across the Cook Strait in the Tasman region. More than 500 millimetres of rain over the past 2 months. More rain is forecast this weekend as well. Flooding can be a death sentence for hop vines going into bud, so growers are pleased the surface water has mostly drained away. The industry here has tripled over the last 5 years and there's no sign of it slowing down.
The July West Coast Weather Report has Reefton winning first prize for the fewest days of sunshine, a grand total of one. In second place, Hokitika, which has had 3 fine days for the whole month. It's also been the wettest July on the coast since 1963. Calving's just starting as the drizzle continues. An excess of gravel clogging up waterways has farmers out with diggers trying to boost the flow. Quite a bit of pastures damaged by pugging, so paddocks being saved for later are being brought in to use earlier than planned. A warm and drying nor'wester has worked wonders on our contact's farm in mid-Canterbury. Winter grazing animals have mostly gone home, but some late calvers still remain on winter feed. Another day or so of wind and tractors will start emerging from sheds to begin preparing areas for spring-sown crop.
Farms and stations in Otago are scanning ewes and after that will test their Hereford cattle for TB. It's also the time of year for a bit more winter maintenance, as well as repairing fences damaged by heavy snow dumps. The rivers are higher than usual and paddocks are described as squishy. Access to some farms is restricted to four-wheel drives as some low-lying roads are still underwater. Southland has had a rather mild winter so far compared to many other regions. Farmers say they haven't had excessive rain, but enough to keep them on their toes. The summer drought and fungus and ryegrass led to a 10% drop in ewe pregnancy scanning rates on some farms. The girls are being moved on to crops such as swede and kale prior to lambing, which starts next month. Sediment from eroded riverbanks is flowing toward the coast and leaving a mess in its wake.
Country Life. For a quarter of a century, we've been bringing you the sounds and voices of rural New Zealand.
Having a compelling story is becoming increasingly important for primary food producing businesses, as is connecting with their customers. And that's where Anna Craig comes in. The 23-year-old has single-handedly transformed her family's egg farming business in North Otago. Cosmo Kentish Barnes is with her in Herbert to find out how.
So I'm Boelli Free Range's marketing and brand manager, but I'm also involved in a lot of other parts of the farm. So the arable side, during harvest I'll be helping with the cropping, day-to-day management up here, obviously the sales and marketing, so very varied role.
Yes, and your parents own the farm?
Yes, my parents and grandparents. So it's 450 hectares and we were in Mahino, so about 5 kilometres north of here, and then came to this site here in Herbert.
So were you brought up here on the farm?
Yes, yep. No, I've been on the farm my whole life, involved in it in various different ways. I finished up at university last year at Lincoln University and come back to the farm full time now.
And you've got a brother who also works in the business?
Yes, yep. He finished up at Rabobank last year and he's back on the farm full time, and his wife Jess is a nurse at the local hospital in town and they've just had a baby.
Mm, lovely.
Yeah.
Did you always intend to come back to the farm once you'd completed your studies at Lincoln University?
I'm actually still in a bit of a question mark stage. I'm not sure where I'm going or what I want to do, but I really enjoy being here for now. I'd like to go away and experience some other types of work, and then, yeah, I'd hope to return one day.
What did you get your degree in?
Agribusiness and food marketing.
Now, recently you have rebranded the poultry business, haven't you?
Yes. I felt that there were a lot of characteristics our farm had that not a lot of other farms had, and I really wanted to sell that story to the consumer. So that's where the idea for Boelli Free Range came around, which is actually the name of the road the farm's on. And so our three key pillars for the brand are transparency, sustainability and family. So the story of having a fourth generation family, I think that's really important. And now with Peyton come along, fifth generation, I think that's really special. Then with sustainability, we've got a unique model where we grow all the grain for our hens and then we use the manure to fertilise the paddocks. We're also solar powered and these sheds are on skids that can move. And then transparency, we have a live video camera 24/7. So there's a QR code on our packaging and consumers can scan that any time, day or night, and see what the chickens are actually up to. So it's quite an educational tool as well, because not everything goes perfectly. So to say this is actually farming, yes, this is great today, this might have happened the next day, you know, with rain and the like. So we're adding value through that.
Have people responded well to that? Do people actually watch the videos every now and then?
Yeah, I actually find it very interesting. I get data on who's watching, where they're watching. I did some analysis a few months ago and there were people from all over the world watching, which was really interesting.
You must have spent a heap of time doing the rebranding.
Yes, it did take quite a lot of my time. I actually did it at the same time as my studies, so over one of the summer holidays it took a lot of time and effort to get that across the line.
Did you have to convince your parents that a rebrand was necessary?
No, not at all convincing. They were always for the idea as well, but it was just the aspect of having time to do it. You know, it takes up a lot of their time, just the day-to-day management of the farm. And me doing the agribusiness and food marketing degree also helped a lot in understanding consumer demand and marketing and that side.
What was the hardest part of doing this rebrand, the most challenging side of it?
I would have to say making decisions. I did get sick of, in the end, you know, font and colour and story and values, and every single component was so important, but there were just so many decisions to make. And often it was, am I making the right decision? Is this what the consumer will want? And so there was a lot of pressure I found around doing that.
And Anna, you also do all of the social media stuff.
Yes, so we have Facebook, Instagram and YouTube. So I use those to keep our customers up to date on what's going on for the time of year on the farm and show our family out there as well. That's a part of our family story.
How do you get time to do that? Because I guess sometimes you'd be out on a tractor all day.
Yes, often it's very much on the go. So whenever I have time, I'm getting content, and it might be that I'm sitting in the tractor sort of trying to plan my content and edit it and post it at the same time. So often I'm on the go and I'm having to make sure my spelling and everything is correct. It is a really big job doing that side of things, you know, making sure you've always got the content that's interesting. But I really enjoy sharing our story with people and then them reaching out to us as well. It's amazing to get that feedback. Yeah.
So has the family moved from cage poultry farming towards free range?
Yes, so historically with my grandparents, it was started as a caged farm. You know, this is in times where food security was a big concern, post-World War II, famines, the like. We've had relatively stable environment, you know, for the past few decades where food security has been really high. And then so that has meant consumer demand can change towards more ethical options such as free range.
What do your grandparents think about what you've done and how things are going now?
They think it's really good. They've always been forward thinkers as well. So, you know, they had their insight to not only start the hen farm but also the arable unit beside it, so that way, you know, when there's fluctuations in grain price, we have our grain on site for the whole year.
It makes sense, doesn't it, if you've got the land to grow your own feed for the chooks.
Exactly, and they started that decades ago, so I think everyone's in the family is really open and looking forward to the future. What's next? What is the consumer wanting?
We are outside one of your hen houses now. Shall we pop inside and say hello to the girls?
Yes, they like to have visitors.
So how long do the chickens stay here for?
So they are reared down on our main site from the age of 1 day old to 20 weeks. When they're at point of lay, then they come up here and they stay here for a further 60 weeks. So this houses 5,400 hens. It's all one level, so they've got their feed, their water, and this is where they lay their eggs as well. And it's all on the one level, and they can wander around as they please. And when it's not raining, they can go outside, in and out, as they please as well. They're quite excited to have people in here. As you can tell, they'll probably get louder and louder.
What type of chickens are they?
They are shavers, brown shavers.
Brown shavers, I thought so, yeah. Do they have the free run of the entire paddock?
Yes, yep, they do. They can go out either side, so we have a north and a south pothole, and that's also a part of our pasture management, so we can, if there has been a lot of water on one side from rain, we can send them out the other side, or we can open up both sides. If there has been a lot of rain, we keep them indoors, and that just stops them creating a mess outside and bringing it inside as well.
Yes. How many eggs do these chickens produce every day?
So we'd have about an 86% lay rate. And every day the eggs are collected. They go down to our main site where our grading floor is, and we have a team down there that packages them.
Are you able to get in,
yeah,
in there?
Yeah.
Hello. I've taken a photograph of Anna with the chickens, and you can see that if you go to our web page. And now we're heading back out because it is a bit too loud in here. Thank you. Since you've done the rebranding, have you been able to sell your eggs in different places?
So our main customer is Foodstuff South Island, so that's Pack and Saves, New Worlds and Four Squares that we sell in. And the Pack and Saves and New Worlds we sell into every single one in the South Island. And then we are in select Countdown stores as well.
Is there potential to move into the North Island as well?
At the moment we're just focusing on the South Island market, but you know, one day if we grow the farm big enough, that would be an amazing goal of ours to achieve.
Yes, and you were saying before that normally if it wasn't drizzly and cold, the chickens would be all around us in this paddock.
Yes, yep, you can go on to our YouTube or our Facebook and Instagram pages and you can see highlights from earlier in the year where they're all running around outside.
Mm. What's on the agenda for the rest of the day?
I honestly don't know. Anytime I make a plan, it seems to change. I think coming up here and just doing some general maintenance, it's often a good chance if it's bad weather to do some inside jobs, but there's also, we've got some grain transfer to do and making some feed.
Anna Craig there at the Boalley free-range farm in North Otago. Anna says the lay rate is actually 97%. The 86% she mentioned in the story is what ends up in the supermarket.
Now we're heading to the Colgate Sale Yards in Canterbury. The sale yards first opened for business in 1898, and now it's owned by Hazlitt, who specialise in livestock broking and auctioneering. Cosmo Kentish-Barnes is on site with Hazlitt's General Manager of Livestock, Ed Marfell.
Once a week, every Thursday, we have a sheep and a cattle sale. And we start with our prime lambs at 9 and then just follow through with the prime sheep and then go to the store lambs at 11 and start our cattle at 11:30.
And how are numbers looking like today?
Oh, the numbers are a wee bit lighter than normal for this time of the year, but that's really based on the last month's weather being so wet and unless you really needed to offload stock, you know, you're hanging on to them at the moment. Look, the yarding's, it's solid, it's slowly built. You'll get into the early spring and the numbers will come out and the hoggets will grow in numbers. So, yeah, it's a reasonable size.
And how far afield do the livestock come from?
We gather from mid-Canterbury in the south to sometimes we get stock out of Marlborough, but at the west coast. but predominantly all of Canterbury, really.
And is it a buyer's market at the moment or a seller's market?
Well, it's difficult to answer that one, really. I suppose it, both parties, all of the sellers seem happy. At, you know, you're at good schedule basis at the moment. The market's pretty strong, really, and it's going into that spring market where it only strengthens. So I think, you know, for this time of the year to have a lamb schedule over 9, 20 or 30 a kilo and the beef schedule around 6.20, you know, everything's pretty good, really.
Yes. Now, Jeff, you are the auctioneer today?
Yeah, I'll start selling the prime lambs at 9 and continue on and finish them.
Yes. How do you set the starting price? Who sets that?
Oh, just depending on what the lambs look like and the weight of the lambs of the pens that we move into. So it's up to my judgment to start the lambs off at a price that's acceptable to the buyers, and then they start bidding from there. But we know most of the buyers that come on a regular basis to our weekly sale.
Yes, and there are some people appearing now. Are they working with you or are they local farmers?
Most of them are agents. The boys have been weighing the cattle. We pre-weigh all the cattle prior to the sale. They do that in the morning. Most of the cattle are penned up overnight and then weighed this morning so that we can produce a catalogue for the intending buyers with the weights on already.
196. 196. Andrew. 196. So what age are these sheep in front of us?
So they're all coming up to a year old. So these are all, you know, hoggets as such.
Hoggets, yep.
Yeah, so born last year. And, so we sort of go through to the hoggets till about October. And then you start to see the first of the new season's lambs, which are born, you know, now in July and August. Mm. They all start to come through in November.
Now, there is one of the sellers here, Alex. He works with one of your agents.
Yeah, Alex is over at Leeston Way, and we get a few sellers who do come and watch, but not a big number.
Alex, you're here today selling some lambs?
Yeah.
What sort of prices are you expecting?
I don't know.
I haven't told him yet.
He hasn't told me how much.
We wait for the excitement.
We wait till the end.
We get the excitement.
Yeah. And how many have you got for sale today?
78.
How often do you sell at the sale yards here?
They sell all the lambs.
All our lambs come here.
Yes. And Alex, it's nice that you come down to watch the sale.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
He loves it.
I love it.
Yeah. Good luck with it.
Yeah. 40, thank 40, you.
Cheers. 41, 42, 43. Hello. It's very quiet. What are you ladies doing here? What's happening?
We are raising money for the Glen Tunnel School, Parent Teacher Association, and have been this is actually my first time on. We're a couple of grandmothers of pupils at the school. The school has been running the food and hot drinks here for years and years and years. I don't actually know how long, but a very long time. Every Thursday, all year. And it's a major, major fundraiser for the school. Takes a huge amount of work from all the parents volunteering to produce food and to be here every Thursday to sell it.
What a wonderful opportunity for the school.
It is.
To raise that extra money.
Well, it's a great initiative of the school to do it. Yes, no, I don't know how many years it's been. It would have been probably decades.
And what's on the menu today?
Bacon, hash brown butties, sausage rolls, bacon egg pie, various baking, and some hot vegetable soup.
Vegetable soup, yes, and yes, the baking.
Gosh, so you put on quite a spread.
Yeah, it's all donated by parents.
All donated.
Do you know how much money a year this raises for the school?
Several thousand.
Yeah. These sale yards have been going for literally for decades, maybe even 100 years.
Now, I am with Philip Shaw, and Philip, you manage the sale yards here.
Yeah, I do, yeah. So the cattle numbers are down a bit. The weather hasn't been that good for us, really. It's impacted a lot on the numbers coming through. But there's mainly prime cattle that are in today. There's a few stores in there. But it's basically been the last few weeks have been a number of very good prime cattle going through.
What's the difference between prime and store cattle?
Weight and condition, yeah, that's what it is. You know, the primes will go to the market, you know, to the works. They'll be purchased and sold on for that. Whereas the store ones, people are able to buy them and put more weight on them, if depending upon their feed reserves and what they've got available. Some of them just need a good top up, and everybody gets a bit of suck of the salve, you might say. Yeah.
How have the wet conditions impacted on your job of trying to keep these sale yards in a tip top condition?
With difficulty. Simple as that. The ground is now chocker full of water. It can't take any more. You only get 2 or 3 mils, and you've got surface water. It's made it very difficult, actually.
What do you put down in the pens to stop the ground from getting too pugged up?
Well, that's the rotten rock. It goes very hard. Done, put in correctly and compacted with the plate, it goes pretty much like concrete.
That would take quite a bit of work because there are so many pens here.
It's a lot of work. It's also a lot of expense. There's just no other way of doing it. Really, it's just keeping up with the maintenance and trying to make it so that it's dry and it's good for the animals, because animal welfare is one of our key drivers here.
Now, the Colgate Sale Yards has been open for business for many, many years, hasn't it?
It has been, pre-1900, and it's had its ewe fairs. They were massive days back in the day. You're going back to when the stock were driven here. There was no trucking. It was they come down from way in the back country there, several day trek. And then it went into sort of a recess period there. It was idle for quite some time, and I think it's about 2009 it was kicked off again, and we are where we are now.
Yes. Yeah. And do you have a background in farming?
Yeah, I've been with stock all my life. Yeah, it's just the way it is. Yeah, you just, they're pretty good animals, are good to work with. Yeah, they don't talk back to you.
Philip Shaw there from Colgate Sale Yards in Canterbury.
Practice for all eventualities and hope it goes well.
You're with Country Life on RNZ National, and today we're in the snow on Mount Ruapehu at Whakapapa Ski Field, where we're meeting a very important couple.
Hello, Echo. Hey, buddy. Ready to come and do some work? Good boy. This is Echo. He is a 2-year-old Border Collie. He's a tri-colour Border Collie, so he's not the classic just black and white. He's got lovely brown on him as well. He's a working line Border Collie, so he's actually come from parents that both come from working lines in New Zealand. Good boy. He's a real character. He's a lot of fun to work with. He's very intelligent and quick to learn new things. He is a pleasure to work with. I'm Lisa Yagi, and I live in Rauremu, which is very near the beautiful and big Mount Ruapehu. I'm an avalanche dog handler for Landside Dogs New Zealand, and my base is this beautiful area.
Echo started coming up here as a puppy to get used to the people and the lifts.
Hello! Just going to sneak through here. Yay! Good boy. When we first went to get in the gondola, he, going from that stationary surface to the moving surface was actually quite a bit of a
wow, what's going on here? And first few times he sort of hesitated and just took a bit of cajoling and treats and things, and suddenly he's wandering in. And, you know, fast forward another month or two and it's like it's nothing, you know. It's just
he's looking at
him.
The view now.
Yeah, he does. He likes to check out the view, don't you, Echo? He's particularly interested when it's actually snow beneath and he can watch the skiers go past. Yeah, I think that's his herding instinct that kicks in and he sort of goes, oh, that's interesting. All right, we can hop out. Here we go. Boy. Hi, how are you?
How are you doing today, guys?
Good, thank you. Got the good tunes going on.
Yeah,
yeah, so this is where it's at the moment. This is where the snow is.
So it's causing a little bit of a fuss
stir,
already, yeah. A bit of a
hi
stir.
There. Do you want to say hello? You can say hello. Nicely.
Hi.
Nicely. Good boy.
Hi.
Boy, this is Echo.
She's doing the avalanche training.
Yeah, he's an avalanche dog. Nicely.
The avalanche dog.
Nicely.
Education is a really big part of what I see us doing as avalanche dog teams. I think, you know, first and foremost, we want to go out there and bring someone's loved one back to their family. But we're really training for a situation we hope will never happen. But education is where we can really get ahead of the game and not end up being the ambulance at the bottom of the hill. You'd be surprised how many people will say to me, what does that dog do up here? And I tell them he's an avalanche dog, and they said, do we have avalanches up here? It's really surprising, because you sort of go, yes, absolutely. Where there's snow and there's slopes, loading and stability issues, there are avalanches.
He's having a quick roll.
Since 1998, 27 people have been killed by avalanches in New Zealand. It's a risk if you're going off-piste or into the backcountry.
People still get themselves into situations where they're not wearing an avalanche transceiver and they need rescuing. And a dog is 100% your best option. It will take a group of searches such a long time to probe an area to find you. A dog is going to be the thing that finds you, because they have these amazing noses, 220 million scent receptors versus our 5 million. They smell the world in 3D. Come on, Echo, come. I'll just bring you in here. Come on in.
We're coming into the
Ski Patrol hut. That's right.
And this is the base, is it, for when you're out training?
Yes, that's right. So it's really important for them to have somewhere where they can sort of go away and not be stimulated. If a dog's sort of getting everything they need all the time, all the attention they want, then when you actually need to use them, they might not be as motivated. So part of what he does is actually spending some time quietly in his crate here. So Echo, up.
Good boy. And Echo just leapt up and you're popping him into the top layer.
Yeah.
He's even got his name on the side of the kennel there.
It does, yeah.
And Rudy.
And Rudy's down below. Rudy's the bottom bunk, Echo's the top bunk.
While Echo's in his crate, Lisa heads out to set up the training area. What makes a good avalanche dog?
A good avalanche dog will be a dog that has high drive, so a real desire to play and work or hunt. Quite often it's a dog from working lines like a hunting breed or a herding breed. Those tend to be the best sort of dogs, but there's also plenty of crosses out there that work really well. Golden Retrievers, Labradors. Labradors are particularly common in New Zealand. Border Collies, as Echo is, German Shepherds, and anything with that high play drive and desire to work with humans.
Are the skills of an avalanche dog, are they different from any other sort of search and rescue dog?
On the whole, the skills that the dog needs is that ability to search and seek out human scent and recognise it, obviously. So for search dogs that are looking for humans, they are all going to be looking for human scent. So in that sense, yes, very similar. And the way that they use that scent or locate that scent, that can be a little bit different. For instance, tracking dogs are looking for ground scent, whereas an ear-scenting dog, which is what Echo essentially is, will be looking for airborne scent. They're using the same sense, which is their sense of smell, but they might be using it in a slightly different way or at different points in the search. For instance, a tracking dog, for wilderness purposes, would be using ground scent first, and then as they maybe get closer to their target, they would possibly use air scent more. So what we're going to do is set up a search exercise for Echo. So we're essentially going to simulate an avalanche scenario. So we're going to use this area of snow out here that's sort of, 20 by 20 metres. And, I mean, we use much bigger areas for training as well, but you usually sort of set one objective and work with that. So today I'm just going to do a smallish area and just bury, what should we do, maybe two articles. And our objective is simply going to be to work around the distraction that's happening here, because we've got tons of people just below us holidaying and having a great old time in the snow. And
so that's quite useful.
Yes, yes, because we want him to be able to work in any sort of circumstances that we might throw at him. And it's very conceivable that when we arrive at an avalanche site, if we're not the first team that arrive, that it could already be swarming with people. So we need to make sure that he can work around those sorts of distractions as well.
And Andy, you're going to be doing the burying of the items of clothing.
Yep, I'm the chief article burier. It's actually good to have people other than me even as well for Echo, because he recognises my scent.
At this point, we should say that you and Lisa are husband and wife.
Yes.
Yep, that's correct.
And what's your role on the mountain, Andy?
General Manager of Safety and Environmental Risk. So I look after the ski patrol teams and the medical centres on Whakapapa and Tūroa.
Right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you one big article. So an article's like a hat or a glove or a beanie, and in this case a big fleecy jersey and a...
Lost property.
Some lost property items. So everyone, this is where your stuff ends up.
Quite useful,
when you
really,
lose
isn't it?
Yeah. Usually just the single gloves and hats and things. Andy, if you could just bury those no more than 20 centimetres deep and leave it reasonably loose, because the aim is to work around distractions, and that's our goal for today.
Okay.
Yeah, cool.
No worries.
Avalanche dogs have found people buried under several metres of snow, and they can pick up a scent from half a kilometre away.
You do have to get to an avalanche site as quickly as possible. Like, time is totally the thing that's against you when you're trying to retrieve someone alive. You have sort of up to 15 minutes, really, from time of burial, where you've got something like a 90% chance of finding that person alive, and that's assuming that they haven't encountered any other major trauma or something that's threatening their life. You know, if you're heading towards 30 minutes, your chances go down to 30% chance survival, and it's really scary. Those aren't good odds. So an avalanche dog is the superior way to be found should you not be wearing an avalanche transceiver. You've got to have one if you're out in the backcountry. If you don't, you really shouldn't be out there.
Give us an idea of how quick a dog is in rescuing compared to humans.
Right, well, there's some pretty staggering stats, really. So, for instance, a dog could search an area of, say, like a hectare in about 30 minutes and cover that area and work out whether there is or isn't someone buried there. That would take 20 people about 4 hours, which is why ski areas in New Zealand are making it, you know, a really important thing to have a dog ready to go.
And Echo is ready to go.
There you go. Ready to go to some work. Everything I'm doing tells him that he's about to go to work. You know, putting the pack on. I've got my gear on. He's got his harness on. And he's already, you can see, he's already pretty excited. Hey, puppy. Hey, going to do some work for me? For him, this is just a big, giant game.
It's all about the game for Echo.
It's all about a game for him. So he doesn't care who's buried under there, or he just wants to find the human scent that's under the snow. So we shape that right from the beginning in small steps, and eventually get to a point where they're finding a full human being buried under the snow. So when they first start off, you get them really keen on a tug toy. So that's their game, and will eventually be the reward. And you just get that drive happening. So you want a dog with lots of drive and play drive to keep going all day long. So you would hide the toy first, or just run away with the toy, pop it down and get the dog to come and run after it and get it. And then you eventually would cover that with a little bit of snow until the dog's finding the toy quite deep down in the snow. And then from there, you start associating finding other things with human scent on them, like shoes, gloves, hats, goggles. You sort of do that same process again, just substituting in that toy. We use like a marker word, yes. I use yes with Echo, so he knows the instant he finds that thing, he's going to get a reward game, which is that tug game. Wait. Poor boys, he's poised. Poised and ready to go. Ready to work? Ready? Search. So I'm watching for any changes in behaviour. You know, he may do a head flick when he alerts that he's gone into that scent cone. We're working up into the wind if we can. We're waiting for the dog to walk into that or run into that scent cone, and then they follow that in to the source. Usually we'll sort of zigzag across it. So this is quite a contaminated area as well, so he's going to have to work a little bit harder. Echo, come. Echo, come. Good boy. Good.
He's digging.
Good. Good. Good boy. So he digs to indicate that there's something there. Pinpoint exactly where the source of that scent's coming from. Come on, where is it? Good boy, yep, I'll grab that shovel. Over here, he's actually dug and shown us exactly where the shoe is buried, and now we're just having a giant game of tug, because that's what it's all about. Echo, hey buddy, good boy, good boy. Ready? Obviously in a real situation now, we'd have our shovel team come along, because we've confirmed that there is in fact someone underneath the snow. And they would come and dig out the subject and hopefully find them alive. after we've found them, which is their best chance if they're not wearing an avalanche transceiver, it's then up to the shovel and dig team to come along and really get in there and dig that person out as quickly as possible. Part of the prerequisites to being an avalanche dog team is that you live within 30 minutes of the likely areas where there could be an avalanche, so in this case the ski area. So for us, we live within that 30 minutes. The alternative is to be very close to a helicopter base, but you know, a helicopter flight, it may be fast, but you might still end up being outside that sort of critical time of 15 to 30 minutes. We just want to get there as fast as possible. So ideally, in the winter, Echo and I spend a lot of time up here. We have, here at Whakapapa, we have another avalanche dog team. We have Rudy and his handler, Blair, and they work up here as ski patrol, which is tends to be the more common way to do the avalanche dog team.
So Rudy's always up here while...
He's always, pretty much always here when Blair's here, and certainly when the avalanche risk is higher after new snow or wind loading events or heavy rain or something that could impact the stability of the snow. But ideally, we have someone with a dog here at all times.
What are some of the risks to the dog when they're out there, either training or actually in the real situation?
Well, obviously, when you respond to an avalanche, there is still the possibility that there may be what we call hang fire, so more avalanche terrain that may release. And so that's always something we're thinking about. Is it safe for us to be there? So obviously, if it's not safe for the dog, it's not safe for us, and vice versa. So those are considerations we make. You also want to make sure you're not fatiguing the dog over and above what they're capable of. An avalanche dog can work sort of consistently for 15 to 20 minutes, and then they're going to get tired. So in an ideal world, you'd have multiple avalanche dog teams working a site and also being prepared to swap in and out to make sure that those dogs don't get overtired. Also making sure they're hydrated. Using your sniffer all day or for a couple of hours at a time is definitely going to dehydrate you, so we need to keep the dogs hydrated. Another risk for dogs is working around ski edges and snowboard edges. They're obviously very sharp, so the dogs can get injured easily. So we really mitigate that risk by doing one of two things: either not skiing with the dogs, so carrying them around on our shoulders if we're skiing from A to B, or we would train them to ski between our legs. So Echo has a command, I use the word middle, and he would come around behind me and pop between my legs, and I'd grab the back of his harness and just ski with him between my legs in a wedge, as you would when you were learning to ski.
He's slightly lifted off the ground?
He's supported. He definitely still runs on his own, but I would just sort of give him that little bit of support and sort of manoeuvre him a little bit, so to speak. He's actually very good. I can actually say left and right, and he'll sort of go with me.
And making sure that your skis are quite wide apart.
Absolutely. I've got to make sure my skis are nowhere near his precious tendons. So, that's very important. It definitely takes a bit of practice, but it's surprising how much they enjoy it. So,
how much do you love Echo?
Oh, I was trying to describe this to someone the other day, and I almost felt guilty saying it's like he's like another child for me. But he really is. He's just this amazing teammate that makes me smile every day. He's just so intelligent, so biddable, and he doesn't talk back. He's just lovely. And, you know, I think for us in avalanche and wilderness search, we often have these dogs, and as much as they're working dogs, they're also our family members. You'd be hard pressed to just treat them like a working dog all the time. We usually have quite strong connections with our dogs as well. You know, we have to think about how we behave and what we expose them to and whether it's appropriate to get them out at particular times. But in general, I think all of us would probably admit, well, just about all of us would admit to, you know, loving them like a pet.
Oh, you're such a clever dog. Good boy. Good boy. Leaf. Good. Woo!
Lisa Yagi and Echo, the avalanche dog on Mount Ruapehu. This winter is Echo's first full season working in search and rescue in the snow. Avalanche dog handlers say they can be close to 100% certain no one's been buried if their dog's been over an avalanche site. But they reiterate you really need to be wearing a transceiver if you're heading out to the backcountry. Take a look at the shots of Lisa with Echo on her shoulders on the Country Life webpage.
Yeah, and there's heaps more photos too. Well, that's it for this week. Do get in touch if you've got some feedback or story ideas. You can be in touch at country@rnz.co.nz. Have a great weekend. Bye now.
Cheerio.